Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be back.
Today we're embarking on an exploration into a really fascinating religious and cultural tradition. It's primarily found within the broader landscape of Islam, yet it's quite distinct from its main branches. We're talking about Alevism.
That's right. And we'll be drawing from a comprehensive overview, Alevi beliefs, history, and status, looking at its core ideas, how it developed historically, and where it stands today.
Our mission really is to unpack this multifaceted tradition. We want to understand its unique characteristics, trace its journey through history, right up to its present-day context, especially in Turkey.
Yeah, navigating the complexities of how it's defined, its diverse communities, and the key beliefs that really set it apart.
Okay, so let's get right into it. How do we even begin to define Alevism? It seems complex.
It really is. It's often described using terms like syncretic and heterodox, primarily situated within Islam, yes, but clearly distinct from the mainstream Sunni path and also from the dominant Usuli 12 or Shia branch.
And its origins trace back quite far, don't they, to the 13th century?
Exactly. Rooted in the mystical teachings of Haji Bektaş Veli, an Anatolian saint from that era, what's fascinating is how he synthesized reverence for the Shia 12 imams with, well, much older traditions, things like Turkic shamanism, for instance.
So the name itself, Alevi, is quite significant, meaning adherent of Ali.
Precisely. And that term, Alevi, really came into common usage in the early 20th century. It replaced an older term, Kızılbaş.
Ah, yes, Kızılbaş. That one carried some baggage, didn't it? Pejorative connotations from Ottoman times.
It did, unfortunately. And, you know, this leads to how some people describe Alevism almost as a relatively unstructured interpretation of Islam. It doesn't have the same kind of rigid dogmas you might see elsewhere.
So knowledge was passed down differently.
Very much so. Traditionally, it was an oral transmission. Spiritual leaders, called deities, passed down beliefs and practices, similar in a way to how Sufi orders operate.
Like a living, breathing tradition, constantly interacting with its surroundings.
You could say that. It's understood to have evolved over many centuries, absorbing influences from diverse beliefs and cultures, stretching all the way from Central Asia to the Balkans. Think of it as a convergence point for various mystical schools, dating back at least to the 13th century.
And possibly even older roots. Anatolian shamanism, maybe Zoroastrianism.
There are scholarly suggestions of those older influences too, yes, which points to why many see it as much more than just a religion in the narrow sense.
Right, more like a philosophy, a culture.
Exactly, a distinct Anatolian philosophy, a way of life, a specific teaching, they use the word already, and even a whole social framework. It's very human-centered, anthropocentric, with a deep respect for nature woven in.
And followers refer to their path as?
The Hak Muhammad Ali Yolu, the path of God Muhammad Ali. They see this as the inner essence, the uzu of Islam. Academically, it's often framed as a specific Anatolian interpretation of Islam, really centered on the Al-Bayt, the Prophet's family.
Now, it's crucial to distinguish Alevism from Alawism, right? Communities in Syria and southern Turkey.
Absolutely critical distinction. While both groups venerate Ali deeply, they're separate communities, different origins, distinct doctrines, different practices, and Alawis are predominantly Arabic-speaking. Very different traditions.
So this ambiguity in definition, Shia sect, Sufi order, cultural identity, maybe even a separate religion with pre-Islamic roots, that ambiguity seems inherent to Alevism's story.
It absolutely is. And it's not just academic hair splitting. It reflects the reality of its syncretic origins, the centuries of suppression which forced secrecy, the practice of taqiyya, and the reliance on oral tradition.
And then the 20th century brought the Alevi revival.
Right. In a secularizing Turkey, which added another layer of complexity with diverse identity politics emerging. Different groups emphasize different aspects, and the continued lack of official state recognition in Turkey just compounds this ambiguity.
Which tells us it's definitely not monolithic.
Yeah.
There's considerable diversity within Alevism.
Huge diversity. Linguistically, you have Turkish speakers, Kurdish speakers using both Kurmanji and Zazi Kurmanki, Azerbaijani speakers, others too. Ethnically diverse as well, but they share core beliefs.
And some key social values seem to stand out.
Very much so. A strong emphasis on humanism and sense of Jisi, love for humanity, egalitarianism, mutual assistance, dayanishma. And, really notably, gender equality. You see this in the equal status women and men hold, their joint participation in the central Sam worship ceremony.
Right.
And even the use of the gender-neutral term can, meaning soul or life, to address one another.
That focus on inner meaning over external ritual, the batun over the zahir, seems really central.
It's fundamental to their philosophical orientation. Hmm. This aligns them closely with Sufism, distinguishing them from more literalist interpretations. For Alevis, morality, ahlak, isn't just encouraged. It's seen as a prerequisite for true belief and meaningful ritual participation.
Which brings us to that famous ethical maxim. Elendi elendi, belin sahib ormek.
Exactly. Be master of your hand, your tongue, your loins. It's a powerful, concise summary of core moral obligations.
And this human-centeredness really shapes their practice, doesn't it? Contrasting with emphasis on, say, daily prayers or Ramadan fasting in Sunni Islam.
It does. Think of Haji Bektash Veli saying, "My Kaaba is the human being," or "whatever you seek, seek within the human." This focus often means standard Sunni practices like the five daily prayers or the Ramadan fast are either absent or significantly modified in Alevi communities. They emphasize this inner meaning and ethical living as the true essence.
And this often leads Alevis to see themselves as inherently tolerant and progressive.
That's certainly how many adherents view their tradition, emphasizing that focus on inner meaning and humanistic values.
The historical secrecy, the Sur, makes a lot of sense, given the persecution they faced.
Absolutely. Centuries of being viewed with suspicion, often persecuted by the Sunni majority and Ottoman authorities, forced them into secrecy. This necessity is a major reason why the oral tradition poetry like Daish and Nefiz, music played on the Saz, became so incredibly vital for transmitting beliefs, history, and values.
Then came the Aleva revival, starting really in the 1980s. A big shift towards public visibility.
A huge shift. Driven by factors like urbanization, migration out of isolated villages, increased political awareness, and, importantly, a reaction against the growing influence of Sunni Islamism in Turkey. This led to the creation of cultural associations, the construction of semaviz, their community centers, and a concerted effort to assert their identity and rituals openly.
But this revival wasn't without its own internal discussions and debates.
No, definitely not. It brought internal debates to the fore about how exactly to define Alevism in the modern context, its relationship with Islam, with secularism, and its place in Turkish politics. It's an ongoing conversation.
Okay, let's dig into some of those core beliefs now. The concept of the divine, especially the centrality of Hak, sounds unique.
It is quite distinct. Hak, meaning truth or reality, is used often alongside or even interchangeably with Allah. For Alevis, God or Hak is the ultimate source. All of creation is seen as a reflection of the divine being. A key concept is God's omnipresence. They use the term lamikan, placeless. God is immanent, present in everything.
And the truest place to find God
is believed to be the human heart. This connects directly to the idea of vadi'i vukud, or sometimes vadi'i mefkud, the unity of being.
The unity of being. Explain that a bit more.
It's a core mystical philosophy. It asserts that ultimately there's no reality separate from God. All existence is just a manifestation, a reflection of the one divine essence.
So humans carry a divine spark.
Exactly. A sever. This makes humanity itself sacred. You see the echoes in Halika Mansur's famous cry, "Anilahak, I'm the truth," and again in Haji Bektash's Benim Kabem in Sandur, "My Kaaba is the human being."
And this shapes the relationship with the divine. Less fear, more love.
Generally, yes. The path is often described as one of ashk, or love and devotion, towards Hak, rather than being primarily driven by fear of judgment. The soul's journey is sometimes seen as an infinite cycle. The Devrai, possibly involving reincarnation, striving towards spiritual perfection, the Insana Kamil, and eventual reunion, Vuslat, with the divine source.
Now, this Hak Muhammad Ali formulation, it's invoked constantly, you said.
Yes. Hak Muhammad Ali Ashkana, for the love of Hak Muhammad Ali, is a common invocation. But it's crucial to understand it's not a trinity like in Christianity or Hinduism.
So how should we understand Muhammad and Ali in this context?
They are seen as essential representations or manifestations of God's attributes. Hak is the absolute divine essence. Muhammad embodies the path, the yol, the archetypal human, the spiritual way followed in the qiyam. Ali represents the light, nur, divine knowledge, the reality of sainthood, alia.
Expressions of God's light and way, deriving solely from Hak.
Precisely. They are not identical to Hak, nor are they separate from Hak. They are essential manifestations.
And the unity between Muhammad and Ali is particularly stressed.
Very much so. There are sayings attributed to the prophet like, "The first creature of God was my light, and me and Ali are from the same light." They're often viewed as an inseparable spiritual entity. This is a bedrock of Alevi spiritual identity and a key point of distinction, even from mainstream Twelver Shia, who also revere Ali.
What are their broader cosmology? angels, other spiritual beings.
They generally believe God initiated creation as a kind of self-reflection. The soul is considered immortal. There's a literal belief in angels, melekler, and fallen angels, sitanlar, with shaitan, or iblis, seen as the tempter towards negative impulses, the nafs, belief in jinn, similar, and the protective power against the evil eye, nazar, is also common.
Are there specific creation narratives?
Yes, there are narratives involving archangels encountering the divine light of Muhammad and Ali. One famous story involves Azazel refusing to prostrate before this light, leading to his fall. Another tells of Gabriel initially answering God with arrogance, "I am I, and you are you," and being punished until Ali reveals divine wisdom, prompting Gabriel's submission, "You are the creator, and I am your creation."
And this ties into the distinction between outward and hidden reality, Zaharian Bayani.
Exactly. The Zahari is the external, apparent reality, while the Bayani is the hidden, inner, esoteric truth. The plurality and separateness we perceive in the world are seen as a Sari illusion, a veil, Bayani, obscuring the underlying Bayani unity of all things with the divine.
So the spiritual goal is to...
to pierce that veil, to realize the Bayani truth of unity with Hawk. To see beyond the surface appearances to the underlying divine reality connecting everything.
How do sacred texts fit into this picture? The Quran, for instance.
They acknowledge the sanctity of the Torah, Zabur, Psalms, Injil, Gospel, and the Quran. The Quran is held as sacred, absolutely, but they also remain open to wisdom found in other sources.
Are there specific Alevi texts that are key?
Yes. Alongside Hadiths and the Najl Balagha, sermons attributed to Ali, the Bayriks are very important, as is Haji Bektash Veli's Makalat.
And their approach to the Quran emphasizes the inner meaning.
Very much so. The esoteric batan meaning is prioritized over the literal zahir interpretation. Unlike many Muslims, they don't generally view contemporary interpretations of the Quran as infallible. The belief is that the true hidden meaning was entrusted to Ali.
And taught by?
Taught by qualified spiritual guides, the Dede, Murshid, or Raber, through inner teachings, often referred to as the Bayrik, which ultimately originate from Ali and are passed down to the disciple, the Talib. This legitimizes distinct Alevi practices and reinforces the authority of the Dedes. It's the theological basis for diverging from Sunni literalism and aligns strongly with Sufi emphasis on esoteric knowledge.
Tell us more about the Bayriks and the Makalat.
The Bayriks, meaning commands or decrees, are vital spiritual texts. They contain Quranic verses, sayings attributed to Ali and the Imams, especially Imam Jafar al-Sadiq accounts of Haji Bektash, allegories, poems, Nefes Deyush, and practical guidance on core concepts like Muzahiplik and the Dort Kapi Kark Makam.
They were historically kept secret.
Yes, often closely guarded within specific Okak families, usually in manuscript form. Only more recently have they become accessible to wider scholarship. While different versions exist, there's a general consistency in their core content. Haji Bektash's Makalat specifically elaborates on the Dort Kapi Kark Makam, the four doors and 40 stations.
Given the history of secrecy, the oral tradition must be incredibly important.
Exceptionally so. Beliefs, history, values, so much has been transmitted through poetry and songs, the Dijmeh and Efes. These are composed and performed by revered poets, the Ozins and Ashok figures like Yunif Emre, Pir Sultan Abdal, and Hatay, who was Shah Ismail I.
Performed in the Sim ceremony.
Exactly. Usually accompanied by the sacred Sez or Baal Lama. This reliance on lived experience, inner meaning conveyed through music and vernacular poetry, contrasts sharply with traditions centered on clerical exegesis of written scriptures.
Let's explore the Dort Kapi Kirk Makam, the four doors, 40 stations. That sounds like a core spiritual map.
It really is. It's a central spiritual philosophy, widely attributed to Haji Bektash Veli and found in works like the Makalat and the Bayriks. It outlines a progressive journey for the soul, moving from spiritual immaturity ham, meaning raw or uncooked, towards becoming a perfected human being, the insana kamil.
The ultimate goal being?
To realize one's own divine essence and achieve unity with Hak.
Okay, so four doors, each with 10 stations. Let's break them down. The first door.
Shiri Kapisa, the door of Sharia or law. This is the entry point, representing the basic external rules and conduct. It's like being born onto the path. They sometimes call it Bel Kapisa, the door of the loins, signifying entry into the community. The level achieved here is Mumin Lake Mertebezi, the station of the believer.
And the stations within this door.
10 stations focusing on basics. Believing in God, acquiring knowledge, ilm, performing basic worship. earning lawful sustenance, avoiding forbidden things, benefiting one's family, not harming the environment, following the prophet's example, showing compassion, maintaining cleanliness, and avoiding useless deeds. The symbolic element is wind or air, yel, and the person at this stage is an abid worshiper. The state is often summed up as, to you is yours and to me is mine.
Okay, moving on to the second door. Tarikat Kapisi.
The door of the path or the order. This is where the mystical journey truly begins. It requires a conscious commitment, ikrar vermek, and following a spiritual guide, a mirshid, or peer. This is the yol kapisa, the door of the path, leading to the zahidlik mirtabesi, the station of the ascetic.
What do the stations involve here?
Repenting for past mistakes, obeying the guide's instructions, maintaining cleanliness, especially in dress, striving constantly for good, serving others, fearing injustice, avoiding despair, learning from experience and counsel, sharing blessings generously, and cultivating deep humility. It's a stage marked by the struggle against the ego, the nefs. The symbol here is fire, a tesh, and the person is a zahid ascetic.
Third door, Marifet Kapisi, gnosis or knowledge.
Exactly, the door of gnosis or deeper knowledge. This involves attaining a more profound, intuitive understanding and self-awareness, nafsini bilmek, to know oneself. It's the ol kapisa, the door of knowledge wisdom, reaching the arflik mertabesi, the station of the Gnostic.
And its stations focus on inner refinement.
Yes, cultivating proper etiquette, idep, overcoming selfishness, envy, and hatred, practicing abstinence, perhiskarlik, developing patience and contentment, maintaining modesty, haya, being generous, acquiring deeper spiritual knowledge, ilm, practicing tolerance, truly knowing oneself, uznunafsini bilmek, and ultimately achieving enlightenment, ariflik. It's about transforming intellectual knowledge, ilm, into divine wisdom, irfan or marifa. The symbol is water, su, and the person is an arif, nowhere gnostic.
Finally, the fourth door, hakikat kapisa.
The door of truth or reality. This is the ultimate stage, representing the realization of the ultimate truth, achieving unity with the divine Hak-Uzun de Bulmak, finding God within one's own essence. It's sometimes called the Gok Aman Yer Anagate, Sky Mercy Earth Mother. The level is Muhiptik Mertabesi, the station of the lover or friend of God.
What are the final 10 stations here?
They represent profound spiritual attainment, achieving humility like the earth, seeing no fault in others, offering limitless kindness, loving all of creation unconditionally, seeing all of humanity as one, yet mish'iki milete bir nazar labakmak, to look upon the 72 nations with one gaze, guiding others towards unity, tevhid, revealing the truth, understanding the inner meaning, mana, of things, grasping the divine secret, and finally, attaining conscious union with the divine essence, vadit ivukud. The symbol is earth, toprak, and the person is a muhib, lover, devotee, one who has submitted.
It's a really comprehensive framework, mapping not just spiritual growth, but also ethical and social development.
Absolutely. It connects the inner journey to community responsibilities and a deepening understanding of the divine. The progression involves ethical refinement and growing social consciousness. The symbolism of the four elements, air, fire, water, earth, integrates it into a holistic worldview. It really underpins their humanism, communal responsibility, and the emphasis on inner truth over outward formality.
And this brings us back neatly to that ethical foundation, Eline, D-line, Blind Sayyid Olmec.
Perfectly. It serves as a practical, symbolic summary of these core moral obligations, fundamental to navigating the Alevi path, the Yol.
Let's recap what each part means, Reline Sahip Olmec.
Mastery of the hand. It means abstaining from theft, respecting others' property encapsulated in the saying, do not take what you haven't put down. It also means avoiding harmful actions, violence.
Reline Sahip Olmec.
Mastery of the tongue, controlling one's speech, avoiding falsehoods, slander, gossip, blasphemy, bearing false witness, summarized as do not say what you haven't seen. It emphasizes truthfulness and maintaining harmony within the community.
And Blind Sahib Olmec.
Mastery of the loins. This refers to ethical sexual conduct, prohibiting adultery, fornication, and any illicit relationships. Haram. It stresses the importance of sexual propriety and respect.
It's described as a demanding moral system.
Yes, sometimes poetically described as Kulan inse, kulakstpan keskingdir, thinner than a hair, sharper than a sword. Morality, alak, is truly seen as a prerequisite for genuine faith and belonging within the community.
And failure to uphold these standards has consequences. The duskin status.
Yes. If someone seriously violates these principles, harms others with their hand, tongue, or loins, and shows no remorse or willingness to reconcile, they can be declared duskin, which means fallen, sinner, or outcast.
What does that entail?
It can mean temporary excommunication from the sem ceremony and ritual life, social isolation, and other communal sanctions. The institution of Duschkundlich shows how seriously ethical norms are taken and how the community maintained its integrity, especially historically when they lacked recourse to state legal systems. These matters were often adjudicated by the deed, particularly during a Gurgutschemi, a ritual focused on accountability and reconciliation.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh Hannah.
Ah, perfect timing. Roj Bosh.
Let's see. Sound of sniffing. Hmm. Smells quite fragrant today.
Yeah.
A lovely blend of spices. Sound of sipping. Oh, yes. Just the right balance of sweetness. Not at all bitter. Today's chai is perfect.
Wonderful.
All right, let's take a quick pause here to enjoy this wonderful chai. We'll be right back to continue our exploration into Alavism.
Sounds good.
Welcome back. Before the break, we were discussing the core ethical principles of Alavism and the concept of Duschkundlich. Now let's shift focus to the historical trajectory. It sounds like the roots are firmly planted in medieval Anatolia.
That's right. The 13th century, Central Anatolia. This was a period marked by the arrival of Turkic groups migrating from Central Asia, and itinerant Muslim mystics figures, often called babas or dervishes, played a really crucial role in the process of Islamization among these groups.
And it wasn't necessarily a uniform kind of Islam they brought.
And not at all. What emerged was deeply syncretic. It was a blend of Islamic mysticism, particularly Sufism, combined with a strong reverence for Ali and the Al-Bayt, the Prophet's family, but also interwoven with pre-Islamic beliefs.
Like Turkic shamanic traditions.
Exactly. Things like veneration of nature, various folk customs, belief in the miraculous powers, kermet of holy figures. Some scholars even point to possible older influences from Manichaeism, Buddhism, or ancient Anatolian and Christian beliefs lingering in the region.
And this particular blend found fertile ground among certain groups.
Yes, especially among the nomadic and semi-nomadic Turkmen tribes. They were often on the margins of Seljuk society, perhaps only superficially Islamized in the Orthodox sense, and frequently in conflict with the settled populations and the Seljuk authorities. They were drawn to this more popular form of Islam.
And Islam emphasizing miracles, saints, spiritual guides?
Precisely. Veneration of saints, wali, reliance on spiritual guides, pir, baba, today, mortuary cults, but with an early and distinct reverence for Ali already present.
And the Bektashi Sufi order is closely linked to this period.
Very much so. The Bektashi order traces its origins to Haji Bektash Veli in the 13th century. He's seen as pivotal in synthesizing these various strands, especially with his formulation of the four doors. The histories of Alavism and Bektashism are deeply intertwined from this early stage. There is some debate whether Alavism was a unique Anatolian synthesis right from the start, or if its deeper roots lie in the folk Islam these tribes brought from Khorasan.
The Babai Revolt in 1240 sounds like a major event in this early history.
It was definitely significant, a large-scale uprising of these Turkmen groups against the Seljuk Sultanate. It was led by a charismatic dervish named Baba Ilyas Khorasani, who apparently made claims of being a prophet or even the Mahdi.
What drove the revolt? Religion? Politics?
Likely a combination. Political and economic factors were certainly at play, the grievances of marginalized nomads against Seljuk control. But there was also a strong religious dimension, fueled by messianic claims and heterodox fervor. Importantly, this revolt occurred among the very Turkmen groups holding what we might call proto-Alevi Bektashi beliefs, pro-Ali sentiments, Sufi leanings.
Though it was suppressed.
Brutally suppressed, yes. But it stands as a landmark. It demonstrated the potent mix of religious heterodoxy and social discontent present in Anatolia at the time, and likely contributed to forging a stronger sense of shared identity among these groups that would later become more clearly defined as Alevi Bektashi. It's an early sign of that anti-establishment spirit.
Then we move into the era of the Kuzulbash and their relationship with the Safavids. This seems like a critical period.
Absolutely pivotal. The term Kuzulbash, meaning redhead, became prominent in the late 15th century. It referred to the followers of Sheikh Haidar, leader of the Safaviya Sufi order based in Ardabil in present-day Iran.
Named after their distinctive headgear.
Exactly. A crimson cap, the Taj, typically with 12 gores or folds, symbolizing the 12 imams. The Safaviya order itself went through a major transformation. It started as a more conventional, Sunni-oriented Sufi order under its founder, Sheikh Safi al-Din Ardabili.
But it changed.
Dramatically. Under Sheikh Junaid and then his son, Sheikh Haidar, it shifted towards a militant, messianic, and distinctly heterodox form of Shaism. This transformation really resonated with Turkmen tribal groups across Anatolia, Syria, and Azerbaijan.
Why them specifically?
They were often disaffected with the ruling powers, the Ottomans, the Akhuyenlu, the Mamluks, and they developed an incredibly intense devotion to the Safavid sheikhs, seeing them not just as spiritual guides, but almost as saints, divine manifestations, even the promised Mahdi.
And Sheikh Haidar's son, Ismail, took this movement to another level.
He did indeed. Ismail, who would become Shah Ismail Apatar, inherited this fervent following. Around 1500, he rallied the Kizilbash forces, largely recruited from these Anatolian Turkmen tribes, famous names like the Rumlu, Istajlu, Tekelu, Shamlu, Dulkadir, Varsak. They conquered Iran and established the Safavid dynasty in 1501.
And Shah Ismail himself, as the poet Hatayi, remains a revered figure in Alevism.
Deeply revered. His poetry is a major part of the Alevi Bektashi religious and literary canon, often performed in the Sem ceremony. The Anatolian Kızılbaş felt a powerful connection to the Safavid cause, viewing the Shahs as their supreme spiritual leaders, their Mushdi Kamil, possessing divine authority. Some Alevi sources frame this bond primarily as a Sufi master-disciple relationship.
But this close relationship eventually diverged. The Safavid state changed.
Yes, that's a crucial point of divergence. As the Safavid state consolidated its power in Iran, it gradually moved away from the more extreme, heterodox beliefs of its Kızılbaş supporters. They established Orthodox Twelver Shiism, based on Jafari law, as the official state religion. They even imported Arab Shia scholars to help formalize this.
So the state religion in Iran became different from the beliefs of the Anatolian Kızılbaş.
Increasingly so. The formalized state Shiism of Safavid Iran became distinct from the folk beliefs and practices of the Anatolian Kızılbaşılevi communities. However, spiritual communication and a sense of allegiance didn't just disappear overnight. Bektashi centers, like the one in Karbala, continued to facilitate connections. Safavid Shahs were still issuing spiritual diplomas, hilafet names, to Alevi deities and sending religious treatises well into the late 17th century.
It sounds like a complex, almost paradoxical relationship.
It really is. The Safavid movement was undeniably the catalyst that mobilized the Anatolian Kızılbaş, grounding their identity strongly in Ali, the imams, and the leadership of the Safavid Shahs, especially Shah Ismail Hatayi. But at the same time, the Safavid state's adoption of mainstream Twelver Shiism, coupled with the major Ottoman victory at the Battle of Chaldiran, created a fundamental split. This forced Anatolian Alevism onto its own unique path, preserving many of the older Kızılbaş, Sufi, and folk elements that made it distinct from Iranian Shiism. So the Safavid connection was both foundational and a critical point of departure.
Which brings us to the Ottoman era, a challenging time for Alevis, given the Ottoman-Safavid rivalry.
Extremely challenging. The Sunni Ottoman Empire saw the Shia Safavid Empire as its primary political and religious rival. Consequently, the Kızılbaş Alevi communities within Ottoman Anatolia were viewed with intense suspicion.
Seen as heretics and potential traitors.
Exactly. Religious heretics and potential fifth columnists loyal to the Safavid Shah. Shah Ismail didn't help matters. He actively sent missionaries, khalifas, into Ottoman lands to spread pro-Safavid propaganda and incite rebellion, often using messianic language. This led to several Kızılbaş uprisings in Anatolia in the late 15th and early 16th centuries.
And the Ottoman response?
Increasingly harsh. Sultan Bayezid II launched campaigns against them, but it was his successor, Sultan Selim, known as Yavuz, the Grim or the Stern, who implemented truly brutal suppression.
How so?
Selim obtained fatwas, religious rulings, from Sunni scholars declaring the Kızılbaş Alevis to be apostates, murtid, and infidels, kafir. This essentially legitimized total war against them. Historians believe tens of thousands of Alevis were massacred in Anatolia around the time of the Battle of Chaldiran in 1514.
Chaldiran was the decisive battle.
Yes, a major Ottoman victory over the Safavids. Selim I remains a deeply reviled figure in Alevi collective memory due to these persecutions.
How did this defeat and persecution impact Alevi communities?
It effectively severed the direct political and, to a large extent, religious links between Anatolian Kızılbaş and Safavid Iran. Facing intense pressure, Alevi groups largely retreated into remote rural areas, often mountainous regions, for safety.
Leading to isolation.
Yes, and this isolation fostered the development of a more closed social structure. Practices like endogamy, marrying within the community, became common. They minimized contact with the Ottoman state whenever possible, and they relied heavily on takiyya, the practice of religious dissimulation or hiding one's true beliefs simply to survive.
Paradoxically, did this isolation help shape Alevism?
In many ways, yes. These centuries of relative isolation were crucial in forging the distinct Alevi tradition we see today. Separated from both the Sunni Ottomans and the 12 Fiyah Safavids, they autonomously developed their unique rituals, like the Sem and Sema, their core doctrines emphasizing the inner meaning, Batan, over the outer Zahir, their social organization centered on the Okak system, and their vibrant oral tradition.
And the memory of persecution became part of their identity.
Absolutely. The sustained persecution, which flared up periodically well into the 18th century and beyond, created a powerful collective memory of suffering and martyrdom. This reinforced group solidarity and fostered a deep-seated sense of opposition, muhalafet, to external state authority. Figures like Pir Sultan Abdal, the 16th century poet executed for rebellion, became enduring symbols of Alevi resistance.
What about the Bektashi order during this time? Their relationship with the Ottomans was different.
It was more complex, yes. For a long time, the Bektashi order enjoyed a degree of tolerance, even state patronage, largely due to its strong historical links with the Janissary Corps, the Ottoman elite infantry.
But that changed.
It did. When the Janissaries were abolished in 1826, the Bektashi order was also officially suppressed, and their lodges were closed. However, Bektashi networks and influence persisted, especially in the Balkans. So while Alevism and Bektashism are deeply connected, the more urban Bektaris often had a different experience under the Ottomans compared to the largely rural Alevi Kızılbaş communities who faced more consistent suspicion and persecution.
So there's a recurring pattern here. Formation, conflict, retreat, and reinforcement of identity through isolation.
Exactly. Syncretic formation and relative autonomy, like in early Anatolia or during the Safavid alliance, followed by conflict with centralizing states, Seljuk, Ottoman, that saw their heterodoxy as a threat. Suppression then leads to retreat and isolation, which paradoxically strengthens internal cohesion, unique beliefs, and an oppositional identity rooted in suffering and resistance. It's a fundamental dynamic in Alevi history.
Moving into the 20th century, the founding of the Turkish Republic in 1923, initially this seemed promising for Alevis.
There was definitely hope. Many Alevis embraced the Republic and Ataturk's secularist reforms. They saw it as potential liberation from the centuries of Sunni Ottoman domination. Alevis participated actively in the Turkish War of Independence.
But the reality of Turkish secularism, laiklik, turned out differently.
It did. The model implemented involved significant state control over religion through the Directorate of Religious Affairs, the Diyanet, established in 1924. And the Diyanet overwhelmingly focused on promoting and managing Hanafi Sunni Islam.
Marginalizing Alevis and others?
Effectively, yes. Alevi Chemevis were not and still are not officially recognized as places of worship, ibadethane, like mosques, churches, or synagogues. This meant they were denied state funding and support. Compulsory religious education in schools was based on Sunni teachings, and a 1925 law banning Sufi orders also impacted Bektashi structures and related Alevi networks.
So despite secularism, discrimination and assimilation pressures continued.
They did. The official state narrative often tried to frame Alevism simply as Turkish culture or folklore or maybe a heterodox interpretation within Sunni Islam, denying its distinct religious identity. And state violence wasn't entirely a thing of the past. The brutal suppression of the Dersim Rebellion in 1937-38, which largely involved Kurdish Alevis, remains a major collective trauma.
Then came the large-scale migration to cities from the 1950s onwards. How did that change things?
It was transformative, it disrupted traditional village life, weakened the authority of the Okak system and the Dede-Talip relationship. It brought Alevis into much closer contact with the Sunni majority in urban settings, sometimes leading to tension, but also sparking new forms of Alevi organization and identity expression.
Leading into the Alevi revival from the 1960s, really picking up steam in the 80s.
Yes. Fueled by urbanization, greater political participation, often aligned with leftist movements, a reaction against rising political Islam and the state's Turkish Islamic synthesis ideology of the 1980s, and also the organizational efforts of the Alevi diaspora, especially in Germany.
And sadly, tragic events also acted as catalysts.
Unfortunately, yes. Horrific anti-Alevi violence, the massacres in Marash, 1978, Sorum, 1980, the Sivas massacre targeting intellectuals at an Alevi festival, 1993, the Gaziosman Pasha riots in Istanbul, 1995. These events starkly highlighted the community's vulnerability and further galvanized the revival.
How did this revival manifest itself?
through a much more public assertion of Alevi identity, culture, and rituals. We saw the establishment of numerous cultural associations and foundations, the construction of semevis in cities, a surge in Alevi literature and music, and increasingly vocal political demands for recognition and equal rights. It marked a major shift from centuries of secrecy to public visibility.
So the relationship with secularism is complex. Initially liberation, then disappointment.
Very complex. The state-centric Lake Leak, by privileging Sunni Islam via the Dianet and often framing Alevism as mere culture, failed to deliver true equality. This continued marginalization became a key driver of the Alevi revival, a response to the limitations of Turkish secularism itself, pushing for a more assertive identity and rights.
Let's focus now on some of the pivotal figures. Ali ibn Abi Talib is clearly absolutely central.
Absolutely central. The reverence for Ali is the heart of Alevism, hence the name Alevi of Ali. They share the core Shia belief that Ali was the rightful successor, the Imam and Veli, saint friend of God. Many Alevis add Aliun Waliullah, Ali is the friend of God, to their declaration of faith, the Shahada.
But their view of Ali goes beyond the historical figure.
Much further. He's seen as the embodiment of divine light, Nur, the source of wisdom, the holder of the esoteric knowledge, the batin of the Quran. He's the supreme spiritual guide, central to the Haq Muhammad Ali concept as a key manifestation of God's light and attributes. And he's the ultimate model for the perfected human, the Insana Kamil.
And the 12 imams descending from Ali and Fatima are also deeply revered.
Yes, the entire lineage holds profound significance. This is a major point of connection with 12er Shia Islam. Imam Hussein's martyrdom at Karbala is a foundational tragedy commemorated with intense grief during the Muharram mourning fast, the Matem Uruku. Imam Jafar al-Sadiq is particularly respected for his knowledge and often linked to the Bayruks. The whole al-Bayt Muhammad Ali Fatima Hassan Hussein, sometimes called the Pensi Ali Abba, five fingers of the cloak family, are objects of intense love, ash, and devotion.
Haji Bektash Veli seems like another truly paramount figure, especially for Turkish-speaking Alevis.
He is indeed paramount, particularly in the Turkish Alevi context. A 13th century mystic, likely from Khorasan, who settled in Anatolia, in the town now named Haji Bektash after him.
His teachings form the bedrock.
His mystical teachings, which synthesize devotion to Ali and the Imams with Sufi principles and Anatolian folk beliefs, are foundational to the Alevi path, the Yol. He's credited with formulating the Dört Kapı Kork Makam framework, detailed in his work, The Makalat.
And famous sayings are attributed to him.
Many influential ones. Eylin, Dilan, Belen, Sahipol, we mentioned. Also, Benim Kabam Insandir, my Kaaba is the human being. His lodge, or Tekke, in Haki Bektas, is the main spiritual center and pilgrimage site for many Alevis. He's a key figure not just for Alevi Bektashi history, but for the broader Islamization of Anatolia and Turkish folk Islam.
Do Kurdish Alevi perhaps emphasize other figures?
While Haji Bektash is respected by all, some Kurdish Alevi communities might place a relatively stronger emphasis on figures like Pir Sultan Abdal. There are regional variations in emphasis.
Let's talk about those poet saints, the Ozanlar, or Aşıks. Pir Sultan Abdal and Şahsmail Hatayi seem crucial.
Immensely important. Alevism places enormous value on these poet saints whose works articulate the faith, history, and identity of the community. Their poetry is a living scripture, in a sense.
Pir Sultan Abdal, the 16th century rebel poet.
Yes. A hugely influential Alevi Ozan and folk hero believed to be named Haydar from Banaz near Sivas. His poetry, written in powerful vernacular Turkish, expresses deep love for Ali, the al-Albet, the imams, mystical concepts, but also themes of social justice and fierce resistance against Ottoman oppression.
His execution made him a martyr figure.
Absolutely. He was executed by the Ottomans, likely for inciting rebellion, and became an enduring symbol of Alevi resistance, martyrdom, and the fight for social justice. His poems, Deish and Nefes, are absolutely central to the Sem ceremony and cherished by all Alevis, Turkish and Kurdish alike.
And Şahsmail I, founder of the Safavid dynasty, writing as Hatay.
Also incredibly significant. As the hereditary spiritual leader, the pir or murshid of the Safaviyya order and the Kazulbash movement, he was viewed with almost messianic devotion by his Anatolian followers. He was also a gifted poet, writing under the pen name Hatayi in Azerbaijani Turkish.
And his poetry is part of the Alevi canon.
a major part of the Alevi Bektashi literary and spiritual canon. His poems, Nefesler and Dayeshler, express intense devotion to Ali and the Imams, explore mystical themes, and touch upon Alevi cosmology. Like Pir Sultan's work, Hatayat's poetry is frequently performed in the Sem, providing a direct link back to the Kizilbash origins and the Safavid connection.
So these key figures together really illustrate the unique synthesis of Alevism.
Perfectly. You have the deep Shia devotion to Ali and the Imams. You have the Anatolian Sufism and folk traditions embodied by Haji Bektash. And you have the history of socio-political struggle, resistance, and even messianic expectation represented by Pir Sultan and Hatay. It's this blend that distinguishes Alevism from both Sunni orthodoxy and mainstream Twelver Shiism.
And the emphasis might vary slightly between different Alevi groups.
Yes, as mentioned, Kurdish Alevis might particularly resonate with Pir Sultan Abdal's resistance narrative, for instance. But underlying it all is the crucial role of these poet saints and the oral tradition using vernacular language and music, especially the saz in preserving and transmitting beliefs, history, and identity, particularly during times when open practice was suppressed.
Let's move into ritual, worship, and community life. The Sem ceremony is clearly fundamental.
It's the absolute cornerstone of Alevi collective worship and community life, often described as the school of Alevism because it's where teachings are imparted, history is remembered, and spiritual formation happens.
How often is it held, and where?
Traditionally, it might have been periodic, perhaps seasonally in autumn or winter, or whenever a traveling Dadi visited the community. Historically, due to the need for secrecy, Sems took place in various discrete locations, a community member's large room, Meydan Evi, a deed's home, sometimes even barns or outdoors in remote spots. The space would be temporarily transformed into a sacred area.
But now, increasingly in dedicated Chemevis.
Yes, particularly in urban areas. The modern Chemevi, or House of Gathering, is the primary location now. A key feature, always, is the joint participation of men and women, usually sitting together, often in a circle, which visually reinforces the community's egalitarian values.
And participants bring offerings.
Yes, food offerings called lokma or niyas. These are blessed by the day during the ceremony and then shared communally afterwards as a sacred meal, symbolizing unity and sharing.
The Semage is believed to be modeled on the Kirklar Meclisi. The Assembly of the 40.
That's the traditional understanding, yes. A mystical gathering witnessed by Prophet Muhammad during his spiritual ascent, the Miraj, and presided over by Ali. This provides the spiritual blueprint.
What are the main purposes of the Semen?
It's multifaceted. It's collective worship, ibadah, with prayers, gulbang, remembrance of God, zikr, invocation of Haq Muhammad Ali and the Imams. It's an educational forum with teachings, history, and ethics discussed in sermons, sohbet by the day, and through the performance of sacred poetry and hymns, saish, nefiz, duvaz. And it's vital for socializing, strengthening community bonds, and reaffirming Alevi identity and values.
Is there a specific type of siam focused on resolving disputes?
Yes, the gerguchimi, the ritual of integration or accountability. Here, the day presides as community members air grievances or disputes, seeking reconciliation, rezaluk, and restoring social harmony. This is also where someone might be declared duskun, fallen outcast, for serious, unrepented moral transgressions against the iline, dieline, bulline principle, leading to temporary exclusion from ritual life.
Are there other types of sign?
Yes, several. For example, the Egerkar Chemi for initiation into the path, the Musahiblik Semi for formally establishing the spiritual brotherhood-sisterhood bond, and the Abdal Musa Chemi, dedicated to a specific revered saint.
Can you walk us through the general structure or sequence of a Senem?
While variations exist, there's a typical flow. It usually begins with the device seeking the congregation's consent and readiness, Ruzelik. Key elements include the ritual lighting of candles or lamps, Sira Uyandurma, symbolizing divine light, specifically Haq Muhammad Ali. Then there's the performance of the 12 services, Aniki Hizmet, by designated community members.
Music and dance are integral.
Absolutely. A zakir plays the saz and sings the sacred hymns. The sima dance is performed. Afterwards, the blessed food, lokma, is shared communally. Often a symbolic drink, the zam, which could be water, fruit juice, milk, or sometimes even traditionally wine or raki, is shared, representing divine love and recalling the drink shared at the Kirklar Meclisi. It concludes with prayers and usually some informal conversation, so bait.
So the Sema really encapsulates the whole Alevi worldview.
It's a living microcosm. It integrates spiritual devotion, social ethics, communal solidarity, and cultural expression. Its structure and content enact those core values: inner truth, equality, harmony, the human as the locus of the divine. It's much more than just worship. It's the central institution for practicing and perpetuating the Alevi philosophy.
You mentioned the 12 services under Gehizmet. That sounds quite specific.
It is. 12 distinct roles are performed by designated community members during the Singham. Symbolically, these roles represent the 12 imams, reinforcing their centrality. It also emphasizes collective participation and shared responsibility in worship and community life. Everyone has a part to play in making the ceremony sacred and functional.
Can you give examples of these roles?
Sure. There's the Deize, or Mushid, the spiritual leader, the Raber, who assists the deity and guides participants, the Gozgu, the overseer maintaining order, the Charash, or Delilshi, the lamplighter, the Zakir, the musician, the Superjeshi, or Farash, who ritually sweeps the space, the Maidansha, keeper of the ceremonial space, the Niyaskar, or Lokmatsha, distributing the food, the Abrikshi, pouring water for cleansing, the Kaprcha, the doorkeeper, the Paiksi, the messenger, and the Sakaka, or Saka, who distributes the symbolic drink, Dhamma.
And the Simai dance, clearly unique and essential.
Absolutely unique and essential to a Levi ritual, especially within the Sem. It's not just one dance, but a whole family of ritual dances. They involve mystical, often flowing and turning movements performed in harmony with the Saz music. Crucially, men and women, the Semashes, dance together.
What does the Sema symbolize?
It's incredibly rich in symbolism. It embodies mystical concepts like the cyclical nature of existence, the turning of the planets, the soul's journey from God and back to God, the shedding of the ego, nefs, and the yearning for unity with the divine. Hand gestures are significant. One palm up towards heaven, one down towards earth, symbolizing receiving from God and giving to humanity. Palms brought towards the face, reflecting the divine beauty within. Palms over the heart, signifying God's presence there.
And the movements themselves.
Often likened to the flight of cranes, ternular, which are considered sacred birds in Alevi folklore. The dance usually has phases. A slow beginning, Adyar Lama, a more lively circular movement, Yirutme, and a faster, more energetic whirling phase, Yildirim. Dancers maintain a respectful orientation towards the Dede.
What do they wear?
Typically clean, modest, everyday clothes. Some regional variations or symbolic colors might be used, but usually not elaborate costumes. The Sema is vital for transmitting Alevi Bektashi traditions and values like unity and tolerance. It enriches Turkish music culture and was recognized by UNESCO as Intangible Cultural Heritage in 2010.
Where do Alevis believe the Sema originated?
Tradition links it back to the Kirklar of Meclisi. Scholars also note similarities with Central Asian folk dances, suggesting deep historical roots. Efforts are ongoing to preserve it by teaching younger generations.
Let's talk about fasting. You mentioned it differs from Ramadan observance.
Yes, significantly. Alevis don't typically observe the month-long Ramadan fast. Their key fasting periods are the Muharram Atem Oruku, morning fast of Muharram, and the Hazar Oruku, fast of Kibar.
The Muharram fast sounds central.
It is. It takes place during the first part of Muharram, the first month of the Islamic lunar calendar. It usually lasts 12 days, commemorating the 12 imams, but primarily focused on mourning, Matem, or Yas, the martyrdom of Imam Hussein at Karbala in 680 CE. Some communities fast for 3 extra days for others related to Karbala, like the Masum Upaklar, innocent children, or Muslim Ibn Aqil.
Are there specific rules or abstentions?
Yes. Most famously, abstaining from drinking plain water in remembrance of the thirst suffered by Imam Hussein and his companions at Karbala. Fluids are consumed, but usually in forms like fruit compotes, hushaf, iran, tea, or coffee. Meat is avoided, reflecting a principle of not harming living beings. Sometimes eggs, onions, or garlic are also avoided. Knives might not be used at the table.
What else is avoided?
Worldly pleasures, entertainment, celebrations, music other than morning hymns, excessive laughter. Also, personal grooming, like shaving or looking in mirrors, and sexual relations. The focus is on mourning and reflection.
How does the timing work? When do they break the fast?
It often starts after midnight with a final meal and intention. Yeah. The fast, or Rusaisma, is broken after sunset, but usually without the elaborate iftar meals common in Ramadan. Some might practice stricter fasting, usundurma, on certain days, perhaps eating only grape seeds on the seventh day, for example.
What's the spiritual purpose?
Inner reflection. Remembrance of the martyrs, expressing grief and loyalty to the Al-Bayt, and cultivating patience and compassion. Importantly, unethical behavior, lying, cheating, gossip, holding grudges, is believed to invalidate the fast. Reconciliation before the fast begins is considered essential.
How does the fast conclude?
It culminates on or after the 12th day with the making and sharing of Eshur, a special sweet pudding made from grains, fruits, and nuts. It symbolizes survival after hardship, abundance, and community unity. The abstinence from water is a powerful act of embodied empathy with the suffering at Karbala, reinforcing collective memory and identity, distinguishing it clearly from Sunni Ashura commemorations.
And the Hazur Oruku.
That's dedicated to the mystical figure Hazur, or Kidra from the Quran. He's revered as an immortal saint or prophet, sometimes seen as an emanation of God or Ali who helps those in distress. This fast is usually for 3 consecutive days in mid-February. It's followed by a Hazur Chemi and special foods like gavut, a roasted wheat pilaf.
Are there other fasts?
Some communities observe others, like the 48 Thursdays fast, the Fatma Anna fast for Fatima, or a 3-day morning fast for Imam Ali during Ramadan, observed by some.
We mentioned the Samevi earlier. It seems to have become the central institution in the modern era.
It really has, especially in urban areas. Historically, dedicated buildings were rare due to persecution and secrecy. SEMs happened in multi-purpose spaces transformed temporarily.
But urbanization changed that.
Yes. The move to cities and the Alevi revival created a need for visible, permanent centers for ritual, culture, and organization. Alevi associations led the way in building them, starting significantly in the late 20th century. The first purpose-built one was in Istanbul Kartal in 1993. Often designed to evoke traditional dervish lodges. Now there are hundreds across Turkey and the diaspora.
And they serve multiple functions.
Definitely. They're much more than just places for SEM. They are community centers hosting funerals, educational programs, Alevi beliefs, says, Sema, even secular subjects, cultural events, social assistance efforts, and administrative hubs.
Their emergence signifies a major shift for Alevi identity.
A huge shift. From hidden practice to public presence. The Samevi is a powerful symbol of visibility, resilience, and the assertion of the right to practice openly.
But their legal status in Turkey remains contentious.
Highly contentious. They are still not officially recognized as places of worship, ibadethane, like mosques, churches, and synagogues. Legally, they often exist as cultural centers or in a gray area, sometimes built without permits.
What are the consequences of this lack of recognition?
Significant ones. Zoning problems, no eligibility for state funding, unlike mosques funded via the Dayanet, denial of other legal benefits granted to religious institutions. Even when the European Court of Human Rights has ruled in favor of Alevis on issues like electricity bill exemptions or exemption from compulsory Sunni religious education, implementation by the Turkish state has been inconsistent.
Government initiatives haven't resolved this.
Initiatives like creating a directorate of Alevi Bektashi culture under the Ministry of Culture have been criticized by many Alevis as reinforcing the cultural framing rather than granting full religious recognition. It remains an ongoing struggle, reflecting the broader political dimensions of Alevism's quest for equal citizenship.
Let's turn to the social and religious organization. The OCAC system sounds unique.
It is the traditional backbone. Based on hereditary lineages, OCAC meaning hearth, which holds spiritual authority. This is different from Sufi orders, where leadership is usually based on an initiatory chain, not bloodline.
So members are believed to be descendants of?
Members, OCAC Saadis, children of the hearth, are traditionally believed to descend either directly from Prophet Muhammad through Ali and the Imams, giving them Sayyid status, or from other revered saints. They often possess written genealogies, Sisir or Stisir, sometimes even officially recognized in Ottoman times.
And OCAC is more than just a family line then?
Much more. It's seen as the source of inherited spiritual charisma, authority, and power. It's the basis for the Dede-Talip relationship. A Dede must belong to a recognized OCAC. Traditionally, every Alevi was born affiliated with a specific OCAC.
Are there many OCACs?
Numerous distinct OCACs, often geographically concentrated or associated with a founding saint. This contributes to the regional diversity within Alevism. You have Turkish OCACs like Oshisen, Sardi Saltik, Baba Mansur, Hubyar Sultan, Shat Ibrahim Veli. Kurdish Alevism has its own important OCAC lineages like Aksusan, Baba Mansur, Kurusu. This system likely solidified during the Safavid period with its strong emphasis on descent from the Prophet's family.
It's a unique form of inherited charismatic authority.
Yes, institutionalized through kinship. It provided stable leadership and continuity, especially during times of isolation and persecution. It ensured communities had recognized spiritual guides. However, it's also inherently hierarchical.
which potentially clashes with the egalitarian ethos.
Exactly. There can be a tension between the inherited status of the OCAC system and the strong Alave principle of Yetmish ikimilete bir nazar la bakmak, seeing all humanity as one. The weakening of the OCAC system in modern urban contexts reflects this tension, alongside the impact of modern social structures that challenge hereditary privilege.
Let's talk about the Dede's role and how it's changing. Dede means grandfather.
Yes, that's the most common term for the traditional socio-religious leader. Other titles like peer, elder, saint, murshid, spiritual guide, or raber, guide, are also used. The absolute requirement is belonging to a recognized OCAC lineage.
What was the Dede's traditional role?
Extremely multifaceted. Ritual leadership was key. Presiding over the sikam, funerals, weddings, initiations, ikrar verme, the muzahiplik ceremony. They provided spiritual and moral guidance, irshad, interpreted doctrine and tradition, acting as a moral exemplar, murebi, for their community, their talipler.
They also had judicial functions.
Yes, resolving disputes within the community, presiding over the gergagachemi for accountability. They were also keepers of knowledge, preserving OCAC genealogies, oral traditions, and often the handwritten bairoks. And they played a role in social welfare, supporting community members in need.
Where did their authority come from?
Traditionally, from their inherited spiritual lineage combined with their knowledge of traditions and esoteric teachings. The relationship with the talip, seeker-follower, was based on spiritual guidance and voluntary commitment, ikrar.
But modernization and urbanization have impacted this role significantly.
Hugely. Urban Alevis have access to diverse information sources, higher education levels, and direct engagement with the secular state and legal system. This reduces reliance on Dede's for all aspects of life. The traditional OCAC system itself weakens as communities become geographically dispersed in cities, and new Aleve organizations like cultural associations emerge.
So the Dede's role is evolving.
It is. There's often a shift towards focusing more on spiritual leadership, conducting SEMS, performing life cycle rituals, and less on judicial or administrative functions. There's a greater emphasis now on religious education and cultural preservation. Some Dedeeds are adapting, becoming more accessible, using modern media, participating actively in Alevi organizations.
Is there consensus on the Dede's authority now?
Not entirely. There's diversity. Some Dedes maintain traditional hereditary authority. Others emphasize knowledge and personal piety more. There are ongoing debates within the Alevi community about the relevance and nature of the OCAC system and the Dedes' authority today. Not all urban Alevis feel a strong tie to an ancestral OCAC or a specific Dede anymore.
What about other key aspects of community life? Muzahiplik sounds very important.
It is profoundly important. Spiritual brotherhood or sisterhood, it's a lifelong spiritual bond formally established between two individuals and, crucially, their families too, in a ritual led by a deed.
Considered stronger than blood kinship.
Yes, often described that way. It involves deep mutual support, shared responsibility, both materially and spiritually, and a commitment to embarking on the spiritual journey together. It represents a core social and ethical framework, fostering interconnectedness and mutual aid.
And we've touched on the importance of oral tradition, music, and poetry.
Absolutely central, especially given the history of suppression. The poetry dayish, nefes of the Ozans and Ushiks like Pir Sultan, Hatayi, Yunus Emre, performed with the sacred Saz, Balama, during the Sem, is how beliefs, history, and mystical teachings have been kept alive. The songs embody their identity and collective memory. The Saz itself is deeply revered.
Despite the focus on oral tradition, is formal learning valued?
Yes. Alevism also emphasizes the importance of knowledge, ilim, at all stages of the Dirit Kapih Kukmakam. The pursuit of understanding, both spiritual and worldly, is definitely encouraged.
As we wrap up this exploration, it's undeniably clear that Alevism is an incredibly vibrant, complex tradition. Deep historical roots, a unique theology centered on Ali and the Al-Albayt.
And that strong emphasis on community, ethics, and the pursuit of inner spiritual understanding. Its journey from those syncretic origins in medieval Anatolia through terrible periods of persecution and navigating the profound changes of the modern era, it really highlights the resilience and adaptability of Alevi identity.
The ongoing quest for recognition and equal rights in Turkey just underscores its dynamic and sometimes difficult relationship with the state and wider society.
Absolutely. It remains a very live issue.
You know, considering that core principle, placing the human being at the center of the worldview, and that ethical foundation of mastering one's hand, tongue, and loins, it makes you think about the universal resonance of those values, doesn't it? Regardless of specific religious or cultural backgrounds.
It does. There's a profound humanism there.
How might those principles, self-control, respect for others, seeking truth within, inform our own lives, our interactions in our own communities? That feels like a worthwhile question to ponder as we conclude our time together here in the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.